Good afternoon, and Bea said she has an extra copy of the sheets.
Yeah.
If anybody needs. Okay, we're good? Great. So just from a housekeeping perspective, there is no class next Tuesday, Erev Shavuos. But God willing, we will have on June 10th and on June 17th. Next week we don't, that's June 3rd. But the 10th and the 17th we do. Okay? Sorry? Yeah, I suspect the 17th will be the last one for the year. And I still don't know what we're doing next year. I've heard bits and pieces from people, some preferring that we go back to doing the prophets and Navi, some preferring that we continue with Midrash. I don't know. We'll have to see. But after this, coming up with a Navi that's going to be challenging enough is hard. There's ample tough material. That's true, actually. I don't remember it. Okay, we'll figure something out. We are in a midrash that we started last time. We looked at it briefly last time. It requires significant explanation. I hope that we will do it justice today. This is the third week that we're looking at a series of midrashim that talk about filling the teva, filling the boat, getting everybody on board. And we're looking at Bereishit Vav Yud Chet, chapter 6, sentence 18. It's found in source number 1 on your sheets, in which God says to Noah, after having explained that he's bringing a flood of water, which we've already talked about, he says, V'hakimosias b'risi itach, I am going to fulfill my covenant with you, uvasa el hateva, and you are going to come to the boat, ata uvanecha v'ishtecha u'neshevanecha itach, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Joyce, actually, you noted to me before that in the class from this morning, right, it was mentioned, Dr. Zolti mentioned, that to lavo is to come, as opposed to lalechet, which is to go. So here also you see that language, uvasa al hateva, you will come into the boat, suggesting also God is there with him. Occurred from that. But the question that our midrash is tackling here, which we said at the end of last week's shir, is the opening of the sentence when it says, Hashem says, I will uphold my brit, my covenant with you. I don't know what covenant Hashem is talking about. This is the first reference we have to God having any sort of covenant with Noah. And so our question is, where did this covenant come from, and what is it about? And that brings us to our midrash, which we'll take a look at in source number 2. We saw it at the end last week, but I think it might be worthwhile as a refresher to just take a look at the text again. V'hakimosi es brisi itach, and I will uphold my covenant with you. Bris atat sarich mipnei haperos sha'ata kones, shalo yirkavu, v'shalo yisafshu, v'shalo yishtanu. You need a covenant for the produce that you're bringing in. Remember that we said that Noah is vegetarian, so he's eating produce, his family is eating produce. The animals are going to have to eat produce because otherwise we'll be short species for the world afterwards. If they're eating animals, then those animals will be lost. So the animals are going to have to be vegetarian too on the boat. So this produce is going to require a covenant, a pledge by God, shalo yir kavu, that it should not rot, should not become moldy, should not become altered. That's number 1. Number 2, bris atat sarich. I see that this thing closed up. Yeah, let's see. Let's try that again. Number 2, bris atat sarich, you need a covenant, because hagiborim, the mighty ones. Haya echad mehem nosein raglo al hatahom v'sosmo, nosein yado al achalon v'sosmo. One of them would put his foot on the tahom, on the depths, and seal them up. Nosein yado al achalon v'sosmo, he would put his hand over the window and close it up. There are a couple of different ways that is taken. The general assumption is that what we're saying is that they're so mighty that they can actually try to block the rain. Block the water welling up from below, block the rain coming down from above. That's how great these mighty people are. Yeah?
Do you mean mighty in a physical sense? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Based on the description here in the Midrash, so it would appear. Yeah. Yes?
So they are reacting.
powerful.
Right. So all we've said is the mighty ones. We have not given any further explanation yet. I've got 55 minutes to go. It's a good question for sure. Hayabali kanes la teva. This mighty one would try to enter the boat. Vahayu raglav mis arkelos, or in some editions mis arbelos, and his feet would slip. He would lose his footing and be unable to enter the boat. Hahu dechsiv, and so there's a verse that says in Iyob, in the book of Job, harafaim yecholalu mitachas mayim v'shochnehem. The Rephaim, I'm translating it right now as the Rephaim tremble, we'll see that, beneath the water and its dwellers, its inhabitants. Okay? So, the statement here, which I think, if it's intelligible, I'm not doing something right. It should not be intelligible yet. But there's some reference to some beings called Rephaim in Iyob and Job. They tremble beneath the water, and that refers to the mighty ones. Don't know who they are either, who are apparently quite dangerous and who would try to enter the boat, and God prevents them from entering the boat. They cannot find their footing. That's part one of this section of the covenant, and then it continues, Ari hayabali kanes la teva. The lion would try to enter the boat. Vayu shenav kehot, and its teeth were set on edge. Unable to bite, like the reference we said in the Haggadah to the wicked son, where you say hakhei es shinav, to set his teeth on edge by saying something very sharp to him and shocking to him. Ta'u dechsev, and they quote another verse from Iyo, from Job, shagat aryeh v'kol shachal v'shinei kfirim nit'u. The aryeh, shachal, and kfir are three out of several terms that are used in Tanakh for lions. We generally understand the aryeh to be a full-grown male lion. A kefir, like kefirim rashu v'ra'evu in Tehillim, is a very young lion. And shachal I've seen rendered as sort of an adolescent lion. It's somewhere in between, a teenage lion. You have the young lion, and then you have the mature lion, and then you have the high school lion. So that's the shachal, and it describes how they roar. It describes their great voice, and it says their teeth are broken. So meaning that they are turned back from their attempt to enter the teva. They're not able to enter the boat. Okay, that's the second of the two references here, to Iyob, to Job. And that's part of the second covenant, which is protection. Protection from these anonymous mighty people, and protection from the lions. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba concludes this medrash by saying, Am Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Nagar Hayisa. He says, you were a carpenter. And I added in brackets the word mir, meaning you were only a carpenter. Doesn't have to mean you were a mere carpenter. We're going to see another way to take that. But you were a carpenter. You built the boat. V'ilulei brisi shahaisa itach. If not for my covenant with you, lo ayisa yachol ikanes lateva. You weren't getting into the boat. Only because of my covenant with you were you able to get in. And thus the biblical sentence says, Vakimosi brisi itach, I will uphold my covenant with you. Emasai when? Likshetikanes el hateva, when you enter the boat. That's the medrash. So, there's a lot here that we need to understand. What is it saying? That's a good starting point. The core idea here is that God is offering a covenant to Noah, right? What questions would I ask? How many questions could I ask about the covenant described here in our Medrash? We already know one question, which is, who are the mighty ones? What else? Oh, surely that's not the only thing that troubles us in this Medrash. Yeah, Marilyn.
Why did there have to be a covenant if it was very clear that Noah was going to be the only one that was going to go onto the boat with the animals? And there seemed that there was a commitment for that already. So why do we need this covenant?
Well, if it's a covenant of protection from lions and tigers and bears, so to speak, okay, except for the ones who belong on the boat.
Well, exactly. So everything's going to belong on the boat. They're all there because they're supposed to be there. So why would you need protection?
oh no, these are people who don't belong. They're not on the passenger list. Well, apparently the ones 2 and not 20. Right? No, that would be the idea, is that there's supposed to be some lions, but not more than, you know, is listed on the registry. Yeah?
Why are these 3 prints in particular? Like, what about getting protection from the lions who are on the boat? Like, those who are on the boat.
Ah, that's interesting. Why isn't there protection from the lions who are actually on the boat? Right? You get protection from the lions who don't belong on the boat. Well, once you're locked in on the boat with a couple of lions, you may want another Brit. You may want another covenant. That's an interesting question. Yes, Joyce.
Why is there only you need a covenant for the produce you're bringing in? The people need protection as well?
Well, protection from?
Right. From whatever.
No, because this is protection from... It's a protection from hostile people outside, hostile forces outside, and it's protection from the produce going bad. So what else are they missing? Are you asking why it's worded as protection for Noah and not protection for the rest of the inhabitants? Because there I would have just said it's all of them are included under Noah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I keep thinking that a covenant means like a two-way thing, and this is only it's like a one-way thing.
That's
so
a great question.
So I'm thinking the first part must have been that when Noah did his part of building the boat.
Good. Usually a covenant is two-sided. Right? I am going to do something, and you're going to do something. So, for example, Jacob runs away from Laban, right, from his father-in-law. Because he's afraid of what's going on in the house. They're abusing him. They're not going to pay him for his work. Whatever's going on, he runs away. Laban pursues him. When they make peace, they set up a mound of stones as a sign of a brit. And the brit is, neither of us is going to cross this line with intent to harm. It's two-sided. A brit is two-sided. God makes a brit with Abraham and says, you are going to have brit milah, you're going to pass down the covenant with me to your descendants, and I am going to protect you and make you many, and so on. A brit is two-sided. Here, God is pledging what he's going to do for Noah. Where's Noah's reciprocation? What is expected of Noah in this medrash? Do you see anything?
He built the boat.
Good. We're going to come back to that as a piece of this, because I think that is an important point. There's one more piece in this medrash, but I think that's true. Now, there's also the point, I think I mentioned this last time, that God says I'm making a brit, a covenant, but there are actually two covenants here. One, to keep the produce from decaying, and two, protection from harmful forces. So there I think it really is one covenant, which is survival, which will have applications in terms of dangerous creatures from the outside, as well as the produce going bad. But let's look at what we can do with these questions by asking another one, which no one has asked explicitly, which is, our Medrash quotes 2 sentences from the book of Eov, from the book of Job, chapter 4 and chapter 26. Eov isn't about the flood. We've seen already this year other links between verses that are in the book of Job and the story of Noah. But each time we had to explain, based on the context, why that made sense. Why the verse from Job fit what our Medrash was saying applied to Noah. Here, these verses are not necessarily so clear-cut. So if we will understand what the verses actually are doing, then I think we'll have a better handle on the Medrash and be able to answer our questions. So I'm starting with the second verse from Job that they quote, because that's the easier one. When they talk about the lions and the teeth of the lions being broken so that they aren't able to attack, take a look at source number 3. Source number 3 is the source for that verse. It's just the greater context. These 2 verses that I quote in source number 3 immediately precede the sentence that is quoted in the Midrash, the sentence about the roar of the lion, the voice of the young lion, and so on. To explain where this is coming in, the first few chapters of Eov, the first few chapters of Job, which tend to be the chapters that people read before they find the book rather difficult, but the first few aren't that hard, present the introduction to Job's suffering. Once that's out of the way, he is visited by friends of his who proceed to attempt to educate him. So that he thought that this is unjust, and he thought that he's been good, he doesn't deserve this, and so on. But we're going to explain how it is that all of this is just and fair. So the initial one is a fellow by the name of Eliphaz, who tells Job, that people suffer for their sins. And if you're suffering, well, you must have done something wrong. That's their statement to him. And that's where this comes in, as they say, Eliphaz says to him, "Kasher ra'isi chorshei aven, as I have observed, those who plow sin, vizorei amal, and who plant struggle." The word amal is more than just struggle, really, but it's a kind of futile struggle. It doesn't get you anywhere. Yiktziruhu, they will reap it. A sentiment you find in various places in Tanakh. Exactly. If they plow sin and they plant struggle, which is a negative term here, that's what they're going to get. So Job, if you did something bad, bad things are going to come your way. Minishmat eloka yovedu. As a result of God's breath, nishmat, neshama, nishima is a breath. As a result of God's breath, they will be lost. Umeruach apo yechlu. From the wind of his anger, they will be destroyed. So those who plow and plant wickedness will be destroyed by God. Those are the two verses that immediately precede the verse we quoted in our Midrash, which says, the roar of the lion, the voice of the young lion, the teeth of the youngest lions are broken. So now I understand a little bit about those verses. Who are the lion? Who is the young lion in that verse in Job that's going to have its teeth broken? Taking this all together? Go ahead, Shannon.
People who sin and think they can get away with it?
Yeah, the people who sin and think they can get away with it. You said, those who plow sin and pray and plan struggle are going to reap the results. Via God's breath, they will be lost. In the wind of his anger, they will be destroyed. The lion, the roar of the lion, the voice of the young lion, his teeth will be broken. The lion is the evildoer. That's what it's saying in Eov, in Job. The lion represents the wicked person. You follow? Those who do bad things, says Eliphaz to Job, those who do bad things are going to suffer for it. But there's something odd in that construction. Because why did you switch to lions? You were talking about people. In Job itself, forget our Medrash. Pretend our Medrash never existed. We'll roll back the clock 20 minutes. We're learning Job now. And in this book of Job, in Sefer Eov, Eov is told by Eliphaz, wicked people are going to be punished for their wrongdoing. The teeth of this lion will be broken. Who asked you about lions? Clearly lions are a metaphor, right? The lion, it's an allegory. It's meant to represent those who commit wrong. But on the face of it, I don't understand who needed an allegory. It's not as though I didn't know what wicked people are. You haven't added anything by mentioning lions. You could have left it with people, and I would have read that loud and clear. Why did you go into lions? So one solution is indeed, yeah, as Rashi in fact says in Eov and Job, the lions are a metaphor, deal with it. That's one approach. However, our Midrash is proposing another solution. Our Midrash is really commenting not on our text, but on Bereshit. Our Midrash is a commentary to Eov, to Job. And it's saying that there was a time in history when animals stood, when lions stood against the righteous. And when was that? The time of the flood. At the time of the flood, lions wanted to harm Noah. They wanted to get in the boat too, and they were set back. Now, I wonder if there isn't a Midrash somewhere that links it instead to the story of Daniel in the lion's den, and uses it to refer to them. It wouldn't shock me in the least. But the idea here is, this Midrash, by using this, is really explaining Job. It's not explaining Noah at all. And what it's trying to say is, you have a passage in Job in which somebody says to him, people do bad things, they suffer, and it uses, and it segues into lions. It's not really meant as a metaphor about wrongdoers. It actually means, no, when lions try to commit wrong, they're going to be set back also. And so it's saying that God protects Noah from the lions. You follow?
Does that mean there's no lions on the boat at all?
No, just the two who are supposed to be there.
Oh.
Two or maybe four, as a separate discussion we may never get to. I think I mentioned it once before this year. There's some debate when it says that you're supposed to bring two and then seven from the kosher ones. It's not clear whether we mean individuals or pairs. So that's its own discussion. But in terms of what we are doing here, that's how our Medrash says that you have lions who try to enter the boat and that they are set back. It's this verse in Job that is our basis. Okay, that was the easy reference from Job. Now we get to the complicated one. Don't worry, we're going to summarize everything at the end and hopefully it'll all hold together. The more complicated one is this business with the mighty ones, or, as they are called in Job, the Rifaim. And I don't know anything here. I don't understand what in the world this has to do with Noah. In context, this is from the heart of the book of Job, chapter 26. There are, I think, 42 chapters altogether. In this section here, Job has already gone multiple rounds with the people who are trying to convince him that all of his suffering is somehow part of a plan. And they've tried in different ways. Some as bluntly as Eliphaz, saying, yeah, you must have done something wrong. Others presenting other arguments to justify what's going on. Well, in chapter 25, there's a short statement to Job by someone named Bildad. And Bildad says to Job, you know, God's almighty, by definition. A lowly human being cannot possibly dispute that which God does. So, in other words, what he's saying is, you don't know why it's happening, I don't know why it's happening, but if God is doing it, it's got to be right. Which is a common philosophy, right? Saying, I don't know. It's simply so. That's Bildad's approach in that chapter. Bildad has a few different approaches that he brings, but that's his approach in chapter 25. In chapter 26, Job begins his words by saying, thanks a lot. You think I didn't know that? You think I didn't know that God is almighty? You haven't added a single meaningful word, Job says to Bildad. He's a little bit angry. And perhaps with reason. But after his opening section, in which he says to Bildad, you haven't said anything meaningful to me, Job then goes on to prove it. He spends several verses talking about God's greatness. He says, you want to talk about how great and powerful and mighty God is? I can do that better than you. And that's the section that we are excerpting here in our Medrash. Take a look at source number 4, please, where I bring it to you in context. He's talking about divine might, divine greatness. Source number 4. Harifaim yecholalu mitachas mayim v'shochneihem. The Rifaim will tremble. It could also be translated as to be born. We'll see if that's relevant, but keep it in mind. The Rifaim will tremble beneath the water and its inhabitants. Arom Sheol Negdo, Ve'ein Ksus La'abadon, the depths are bare before him, before God. There is no cover for the place of destruction, meaning nothing is concealed before God. God sees all the way down to the depths. Notet Safon Al Tohu, he extends the north over Tohu. Tohu is the initial state of creation, described in the second verse in Genesis and Bereshit. Tohu Vavohu, and the description here is that God creates the settled world by extending land from the north to the south. He creates this land and extends it over the depths. So the depths don't, nothing is concealed before God because God is the one who put the land there in the first place. So he is notet safon al tohu, tola eretz al belima, which you may recall from the liturgy of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, tola eretz al belima chai v'nora, Chai v'kayam naro marom v'kadosh, from one of the piyutim, one of the classic poems included in the liturgy. He says, the depths are laid bare before God. There is no cover for the place of destruction. He extends the north over tohu. He suspends the land over nothingness. Bili ma. There's nothing there. Sorer mayim be'avav. He binds up water in his clouds. Velo nivka anan tachtam. No cloud splits open beneath them, meaning the water stays in the cloud until God says it's supposed to rain. That's the message here in these verses. The message is about divine greatness. The message is that God can see everything way down to the depths, and that the rain goes up into the clouds at God's word, and it will come down only at the proper time. That's the message. What in the world, though, are Rifa'im that are trembling beneath the water and its inhabitants? What in the world are Rifa'im? So that's what we need to know in order to be able to understand anything else here. The entire key to our medrash is this odd word, Rifa'im. So there are two explanations, with a third I'll throw in there. But there are two primary explanations for what Rifa'im are. Don't worry if we're getting distant from our medrash. I believe that we will come back to it in the end. The first explanation of Rifa'im is that Rifa'im refers to a nation of people. They live in the land of Canaan, which is a land that becomes Israel, very early on. Correct. If you take a look, please, at source number 5. Source number 5 comes from the Parsha of Lech Lecha Bereishit in Genesis, and it's part of a description of a battle between 4 kings and 5 kings. The 4 mighty kings defeat the 5 other kings. That's the battle in which Lot, Avram's brother-in-law, is taken captive, and then he goes to war to save him. So take a look, please, at source number 5 as the verse sets up that battle. But Kedar laOmer v'hamalachim asher ito. Kedar laOmer, who was a king, and his associate kings came along. Vayakuet Rifa'im v'Ashterot Karnayim, and they struck the Rifa'im in a place called Ashterot Karnayim. Ve'et haZuzim beham, and the Zuzim along with them. Zuzim often means coins, but it doesn't here. Ve'et haEimim b'Shavei Kiryatayim, as well as the Eimim in Shavei Kiryatayim. So if you had to, just based on source number 5, if you had to explain what Rifa'im, Zuzim, Eimim are, what are they?
Tribes.
Some kind of group, bands of people who lived in the land who got beat bad by Kedar laOmer and his associate kings. Right? That's a reasonable explanation. We fast forward in the biblical text to Deuteronomy. And we learn, as the Jews are camped on the shores of the Jordan River waiting to come into the land, we get this verse regarding that land, source number 6, or a particular area in that land. Eretz Rifa'im techashev afi. It is also considered the land of the Rifa'im. Why? Because Rifa'im yashvu balifanim. The Rifa'im lived there before. V'amonim yikru'u em zamzumim. The Ammonites call them zamzumim, which is a great name, by the way. It has it just sort of flows off your tongue, zamzumim. So you have, again, Rifa'im as some kind of tribe that they knew about, that historically had lived there, and that is there no longer, because they got beaten by Kedar laOmer. So we assume.
They get beaten if they were the great ones.
Well, we have to see what's going on, yeah?
They're not just an ordinary people.
Yeah, why?
Well, they're called the mighty ones.
We didn't see that yet.
No, we saw it in the Midrash.
Ah, in the Midrash. Well, we're not ready for the Midrash yet. Right now, they're a nation. That's all we know so far. Flip the page, and then we'll know more. Sorry, in? No Rifa'im. We don't use the word Rifa'im there. I know what you're thinking of, and hold the thought, please. We'll get there. I know nothing about any angels. Right now, they're a nation. Let's see what happens.
But maybe I'm thinking the same thing as Joyce. Isn't there
aren't they part of the peoples that are referred to before Noah?
Yes.
Their name does not show up. The first appearance of Rephaim biblically is the verse I gave you in source number 5. They are not mentioned pre-flood. However, there is stuff we have to talk about. I'm glad that everyone's engaged in it. This is great, because I broke my head to get this. So, you know, let's all do this together. But take a look at source number 7. A verse from Devarim, from Deuteronomy. This will satisfy the giant hunters. Ha'emim lifanim yashvu ba. The emim lived there before. Am gadol v'rav v'ram ka'anakim, a large and great nation, mighty like giants. Those are emim. The word emim means what? What is ema in Hebrew? Good. You just explained it with another Hebrew word, though. What does ema mean? Fear, terror, pachad, correct. Ema is a term for great fear. The emim are the fearsome ones, the ones everybody is afraid of. Now, keep on reading. Rifa'im yechashvu avheim. They are also considered Rifa'im. These Amim were also known as Rifa'im. They go hand in hand. Ka'anakim, they're like the giants. Va'moavim yekulem Amim. And the Moabites call them Amim. So they're Rifa'im, they're Amim. They're the same clan. They're the same tribe. Different people called them by different names. And they are, apparently, giants. Sealing the deal. Take a look at source number 8. A verse also from Deuteronomy regarding somebody who is very central to our story, Og, the king of Bashan. Listen to this verse. Kirak Og, melech ha-Bashan, nish'ar mi'yeser ha-Rephaim. Only Og. This is now at the cusp, on the cusp of the Jewish entry into the land of Canaan. By this time, only Og, king of Bashan, remained from the remnant of the Rephaim. Nish'ar mi'yeser ha-Rephaim. He is the last of the Rephaim. Okay. Well, listen to this description of Og. Hine arso eres barzel. His bed was made of iron. Hallo, he... That's fine. You know, we all have beds made of metal, but he didn't have a mattress. His bed is made of iron. Hallo, he barabat b'nei Amon. Isn't it in Rabbah of the Ammonites? Isn't that where they keep his bed? Tesha Amos Arka, 9 cubits long. We've talked about cubits in terms of the measurements of the boat. We said that a cubit in our measurements is 21.6 inches, about a foot and 3/4. Multiply that by 9, that's how long his bed is. That's a big bed. Ve'arba Amos Rochba, and it's 4 cubits wide. Be'amad Ish, with a human cubit, meaning we're not measuring by his arms, we're measuring by human arms. Because remember the cubit measure we said goes from elbow to hand. So we're saying we're going based on the human measurement. That's how many cubits this bed of his is. Og is a holdover from the Rephaim, the last holdover from the Rephaim, and he is oversized. So the Rephaim are a nation of giants. Somehow, Kedar La'Omer and crew defeated them. We don't yet know how. We don't know where these giants came from. There's a whole lot we're not aware of. Not to mention, well, trying to figure out the best way to introduce this. Okay, I'm going to mention it this way. For those of you who know Baron Dasberg, Baron Dasberg is a shaliach from Israel. He teaches at Chat. So he wrote an article regarding Rephaim in which he pointed out a problem. I mentioned that the earliest appearance of Rephaim in the Torah is source number 5, which is post-flood. That's the time of Abraham. The time of Abraham is source number 5. And the problem that he pointed out is that 4 chapters before this in Bereshit, in Genesis, we get a list of all the tribes, all the nations that descended from Noah. 70, in fact. That's where we get the idea of 70 nations. And they listed all of them. And the Rephaim don't show up on the list. Where are they then? How do you have Rephaim, whatever you want to call them, Rephaim, Emim, Zamzumim, none of them show up on this list. So where did they come from if they're not descendants of Noah? To which the answer may be, they're from, yeah? They're from before Noah. They're not descendants of Noah. They are contemporaries of Noah who survived the flood. How? That's a really good question. How in the world do you survive the flood? So, the Medrash tells us, we saw at one point this year, that Og survives the flood by hanging on to the boat. Og hangs on, he's this huge giant. He hangs on to the boat, and there's a whole discussion in the Midrash, we saw it, that talked about the water around the boat being cooled off so that it's not boiling, because that way also it saved the boat from harm. And Og survives there. That fits various ideas regarding Og that are beyond the scope of what we're going to get to, except that I will mention that there's a biblical text that calls Og Hapalit, the refugee. And so the idea is he's a refugee from the flood. That Og's, right, that's the one. You got it. So Og is the last of the Rephaim, because he survives the flood and he reconstitutes his nation. After the flood is over, he's the only one of the Rephaim to survive. But he rebuilds the nation of Rephaim until Kedar Laomer and his mighty four-king army come along and demolish the Rephaim. And then Abraham comes along and he defeats the armies of the four kings. You follow? So Barone, in his article on this topic, which is available online, by the way, if anyone wants, I can send you the link. I thought I was going to put it on the sheet, but I see that I didn't. But Barone makes the argument that if you look at the evidence presented in the Torah regarding these Rephaim, that they are giants, and that Og survives from before the flood until the Jews are on the cusp of entering the land of Israel. That is a very long time. I'm not entirely sure offhand, but I think you're talking about something like 1,000 years. Long time. Until Moshe kills him, which puts an end to Og. But the point is that he suggests, as a potential hypothesis, that we're talking about not a human being at all, but we're talking about some kind of animal, some kind of prehistoric beast, dinosaur, whatever you want to call it. Dinosaurs don't exist at the same time as human beings, leave that be, but it's some kind of prehistoric beast that is mighty and that roams through the area, and that Og is one of those. He's not human at all. It's an interesting idea. Frankly, I have some problems with it, such as the fact that they're identified as a clan alongside human clans. It doesn't sound like the text at all differentiates, but I thought that was a creative idea. And his main point stands, which is, they're pre-flood. Now, where did they come from pre-flood, that they should be giants? So that takes us back to a verse that we discussed ages ago, in which we are told that the Bnei HaElohim, or Bnei HaElokim, depending on how you read those words, married the women of the human race and produced children. And the question is, what are those Bnei HaElohim? And one explanation of it indeed suggests that somehow or other they are angels who criticized humanity and said, look at these terrible human beings. God, we would be better servants if we were human beings. And God says, okay, go try it out. And says, okay, I'm putting you into human form. And they come down to earth, not as the fallen angel idea, but rather they come down to earth and take human form, and sure enough, they sin like everybody else. That's one explanation. And their kids would then be these giants. The other explanation, more literal, is that the word Elohim is often used biblically to refer to powerful beings, just people who are powerful. It's used for judges, for example. They're referred to as Elohim. And so it just means people who were powerful people. And it doesn't have to involve anything supernatural. But there were some people who were bigger than everybody else, and this is this race of giants. However you take that, doesn't actually affect our Medrash, so I don't want to get distracted by it. That's why I didn't bring sources on that here on the sheet. The point that we do need to know is that the Rephaim, as understood there, refers to a nation that preceded the flood, because they're not descended from post-flood people, and they are giants. Yes?
Did they live in Noah's community too, or they were somewhere else?
We don't know anything about Noah, whether he had a community, remember. But yes, they're in that region.
Okay, because what we've been studying is Noah was a good person, everybody else was evil. So are these people evil?
That would be the understanding, just like the rest of his time.
What we also concluded was that Noah was good, and we continued. But now we're saying some evil people survived.
At least one, anyway. Oh, yes.
And then his nation again. So we don't just have the good people surviving, we have...
Yes, and that is a major question. Right? It's one thing to say Noah survived because he found favor in God's eyes. What's Og's excuse?
Yeah.
Why does he get it? Uh-huh. So, without taking us too far afield, but to at least address the question somewhat, the Medrash suggests that Og is the one who escapes from the war of the four kings and the five kings, which we now know he would have been involved with because he fought against those four kings, right, who defeated the Rephaim. So we know that Og is in that war. So he escapes. Well, let me build this a little bit differently because I think it'll make more sense. Here are the facts that we know. Og is one of the Rephaim that we saw explicitly in source number 8. So Og is from the Rephaim. That's number one. Number two. We know the Rephaim were defeated by Kedarlaomer in the war involving the four kings. That was the verse in source number 5. So Og is now on the scene for that battle. Number 3, we know that Og is not killed in that war because we are told that in source number 8 that he remains. He's still around. Follow? So Og is of the Rephaim. Og is at the war of the four kings and the five kings, but unlike the rest of the Rephaim who are defeated, he survives till the time of Moshe. So building on those three pieces of evidence, the Medrash suggests that when we're told there was a lone refugee who is known in the Torah as the refugee who came to Avraham and told Avraham about Lot being taken captive, that's Og. And that explains why he would have survived the flood. Because there has to be somebody who's going to come along and tell Abraham that Lot has been taken captive. Because if Abraham doesn't find out that Lot has been taken captive, do you know what will happen? Lot will never have his two sons, Ammon and Moab. Which means that Rut, the Moabite, will never be born. It's like Back to the Future, right? If you remember those movies? And as a result, King David will never emerge from Ruth, the Moabite. So in order to ensure that, Og has to survive the flood. And therefore, he's going to hang out outside the boat. We are all tools in this grand plan.
You may be the most important person.
Og is one of the most important people in the Torah. How do you like that? Yes, Shana.
So... if the idea is that Og rebuilds his people after the flood, is there a Mrs. Og hanging out in the boat with him?
So that's a really good question. The answer is probably not. No, hang on. The answer is probably not. Og's children are not mighty Rephaim. They don't carry the gene. The reason I say that is twofold. Number one, because Kedarlaomer and crew are able to defeat them. If Og is able to rebuild his nation at his size, I'm sorry, there's no way, I don't care who you are, you're not defeating them. Not in an age when you don't have weapons that can fire from a distance. I mean, you have arrows perhaps, but that's about it. Good luck. That's number one. Number two, because he is described as being outsized like nobody's ever seen. If he produced a race of people like that, I find it hard to believe that, you know, he's going to stand out. I could be wrong. It's possible that, yes, there's a Mrs. Og somewhere. It's also possible that Og's kids have some of his height, which is why they're still known as being a fearsome nation. They're still up there. But not in the class of an Og who has a bed that's about 15, 16 feet long. you know, and 7 feet wide. Rita,
you said that then he
So yes, he rebuilds it. Again, I don't think they're at his size, but they are. They become the new Rephaim post-flood.
So who are they? Like,
they are apparently kids he has, people he comes along with, that, you know, that come along with him. Yeah.
So they're his own kids?
His own kids and whoever joins. We don't know. We're missing information. We can hypothesize however we like. Yeah.
So we're not all descendants of Nephilim.
Except that they're defeated. And except that we don't look like them. You know, we're not at their scale. Maybe there's tall Scandinavians. I don't know.
Isn't it like the Midrash that says that the descendants of all descendants of Noah's daughters?
That the... Say this again?
The descendants of the Rephaim.
Yeah. Sired Noah's daughters?
Married
Noah's daughters? Not that I know of. It says that they married human wives... Before that's the Bnei Elohim, and they produce, apparently, according to this, if we're accepting the linking of the stories, they produce the Rephaim. Yeah. Okay. So let's get back to where we were with this, because otherwise we're never going to understand anything. We need that. So what we've said is that you have a verse in Eov in Job, which describes God as being so mighty that he sees the depths. Into the depths, and the Rephaim tremble beneath the water. Now I'm briefly going to mention, there's another explanation of Rephaim, which actually takes Rephaim as spirits of the dead. That's what Orah was thinking about with Shaul, but we generally assume that's not what the Rephaim are here. But I brought you a couple of references, because you can't ignore it. Source number 9, a verse from Yeshaya, from Isaiah. He speaks of the day when God will have mercy upon us and will redeem the Jewish people, and the way the world is going to celebrate, and he describes the spirits of the dead joining in the celebration. In source number 9, he says, "The depths from below..." I'm just going to read the English quickly because we're going to be out of time otherwise. "The depths from below tremble for you to greet your arrival, you meaning the Jews. The Rephaim are awakened for you. All of the leaders of the land, all of the kings of the nations are raised from their thrones." And Rephaim, if you take a look at source number 10, Mitzudat Sion, a classic commentary by Rabbi David Altshuler to Tanakh, says that the reason why Rephaim would be a term for the dead is because of the word Rapha. Resh Pei Hei, not Aleph, Resh Pei Hei. This is not connected to curing. But Resh Pei Hei is to be chalash, to be weak. They are weakened via the malach of death. Or alternatively, as Rashi says it in source number 11, that Gehinom, the netherworld, is a place that weakens creatures. So there is a view. Let's go back now to our verse, to Job chapter 26, sentence 5, which is the verse that our Midrash quoted. It said that the Rephaim, Yicholalu mitachas mayim, they are something, the Rephaim are beneath the water. So now I think we will be able to make clear how in the world our Midrash took that sentence and applied it here. There are two, well, first of all, it seems clear here that Rephaim is not actually a reference to the Canaanite nation, but it could be because there were a lot of them who died in the flood. Only Og survived. So When it says the Rephaim tremble beneath the water, well, let me take this. I'm sorry, I jumped the gun. I shouldn't have jumped the gun. Let me do it in the order that I should. If you want, you can take Rephaim in 26:5 in Job, right? If you go back to source number 4, you see it. The Rephaim will tremble beneath the water and its inhabitants. So you can take that to refer to the dead, right? It's the spirits of the dead. We are describing here, remember what Job is doing. He says, "I recognize divine power. I see that God has power over the depths, even the souls that are beneath the water," meaning the souls of the dead, "are laid bare before God." God can see everything that is down there. That's one way to take it. I brought you an Ibn Ezra line in source number 12 that I'm going to skip. You can take a look at it yourself, but I'm going to skip it in the interest of clarity. But the point is that Rifa'im here refers to the dead, if I take this sentence literally, and it's saying that God is so powerful. This is Job talking. Remember, he says, yeah, I know how powerful God is. God is so powerful that he sees the dead beneath the water. Got it? That's one take. That's the literal take. But our Medrash comes along and says, not so fast. We don't necessarily think that that verse in Job is talking about the spirits of the dead beneath the water. You know why not? Because are the dead described normally as being beneath the water? No. They're described as beneath the earth.
Except because of the flood.
Hang on. The dead are normally beneath the earth. And so, our Medrash says, Rifa'im in this verse doesn't refer to spirits of the dead, generally. It refers to the Rifa'im who were the tribe we described. And it builds on the following hints, I think. Number one, I cataloged this for you in source number 13. Number one, because as we've now seen, the Rifa'im are a tribe that is pre-flood. And most of them, other than Og, die in the flood. That's number one. Number two, whatever the Rifa'im are, they are trembling beneath the water. Right? They're trembling beneath the water. It describes them as having been underneath water, as in flood. Number three, the general sentences there in Job that surround that in context, even what I quoted for you in source number four, speak of God's power over water. He binds up water in the clouds. It doesn't descend until God tells it to. That section in Job, is all about water, which makes sense if you're talking flood. And it fits the idea that Og is a survivor of the flood as well, but that's already beyond what we're doing right now. The point here is, I shouldn't have really brought in Og on that point. The point here is that these Rifa'im are actually the nation of that time, the giants of that time, who would have posed a major threat to Noah. Poor Noah built a boat. He's going to survive the flood. Along come the Rifa'im and they say, who are you kidding? If anyone's getting on that boat, it's us. We're the ones who are going on that boat, not you. And so, go back to our Medrash in source number two. Bris atat sarich, you need a covenant, Noah. Because these mighty people are able to put a foot over the depths and block the water and put a hand up to the heavens to block the rain, so to speak. And they want to get on the boat. And God says, I am the one who is going to protect you. And he quotes the verse from Job about how the Rifa'im end up dead beneath the water. You follow? That's the idea. And the word Yecholalu, I'm now taking a step further with this in my own head. I wonder also, the word Yecholalu admits of multiple explanations. One explanation is to tremble. Another explanation is to be born, which I included there on the sheet. A third explanation is to become a halal. You know what a halal is? A corpse. They become a corpse beneath the water. So that also, I think that also fits. Okay. So our Medrash is saying that God is going to protect Noah, number one, by keeping the produce, and number two, by protecting him from these dangerous Rifa'im, as well as the lions we already saw from elsewhere in Job. Okay, let's bring this together now, because we still have some questions to answer. This is the Brit, we said. This is the covenant that was referred to in source number one, when God said, this is my Brit with you. How do I know that this is the covenant? Because look at the wording in source number one. Vakimosi es brisi itach. I'm going to uphold my covenant with you. Uvasa el hateva. And you're going to get into the boat. It is not a random covenant. You ask the question of, how do I know it's not a covenant about protection from the animals who are on the boat? Because it's a covenant about getting in. It's a covenant that says, you're actually going to be able to get in. That's the idea. And as we said when we introduced the Medrash last week, this is a new Brit. It's a new covenant. The original covenant with humanity is gone because they broke it. This is now going to be a new covenant. And now to go back to the question of, well, isn't the covenant normally two ways? We look at our Medrash and what it emphasizes. Number one, on the produce. Brit ata tzarich mebnei ha-peirot sha'ata kones. You need a brit for the produce that you bring in. What Noah's side was to bring in the produce. You brought in the produce, now my side will be to keep it intact. And then in terms of the boat, God said, Nagar hayita, you were the carpenter. Not you were a mere carpenter, you did it. You built the boat. And because you built the boat, now I'm going to produce a covenant that will let you enter it. You did your part, and now I am going to do mine. That, I think, is the idea. God says, I'm going to make your endeavors successful. So, what is our Medrash here to teach us? I think two major lessons. Number one, even when you have done everything, you still need to rely on God. Noah did, really, what, you know, to mix systems. He performed a Herculean task. He built this monster-sized boat. That's not a small thing. Granted, we saw an earlier medrash that suggested that the boat built itself, that the boat helps in the process. But Noah has done this incredible thing. And God says to him, because of what you did, I will make it a success. It's not all done, but I'm going to go the rest of the way for you. I will make the produce last, and I will also keep out these Rifa'im, the pre-flood, antediluvian, for those who like the word. This antediluvian tribe, I'm going to protect you from them. Og will survive because we need him later in the story. Because if Og doesn't survive, Abraham is not able to save Lot. And therefore you don't get the nation of Moab. And therefore you don't get Ruth. And you don't get King David. So we need Og to survive hanging on to the boat. But the rest of them are all going to be gone at that point. The Rephaim will be beneath the water because I'm going to take care of you. That's number one. Lesson number one is that when a human being does what he's supposed to do, God will go the rest of the way. And the other is that a new brit is always possible. The old brit is gone because the human beings destroyed it. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. But God says, I'm going to make a brit with you. And my brit with you, again, is you do what you're supposed to do, Noah, and I will take it the rest of the way. And that's the message that we're all of this is meant to draw from source number one, when God says, I'm going to uphold my covenant with you. You did what you had to do, I'm going to do what I have to do, and therefore, ubatal hateva, you will merit to enter the boat. God willing, we will continue in 2 weeks. We have much more to see yet in this sentence, and we have 2 weeks of Midrash class left, so hopefully we'll see some of it.
Okay.
Thank you.